Okay, so I will assume that you know more or less about Jung, but that you don't know about embodied imagination. So let me, if I say things that you already know, I'm not talking down on you, I just try to start from scratch. And I think that embodied imagination actually began in 1912 or 1913. And that was, it's described in Jung's Red Book. That was the moment that there's a lot of images coming to him. And let me back up for a moment. I'm going to back up a lot of times. Jung was in a particular tradition. I'm going to be talking about the tradition. This didn't come all out of the mind of Jung. This is a long tradition. We're dealing with a tradition that's about 2,000 years old. But Jung, for our time, went back into it. And so lots of images started to emerge. You have to see that around 1912, he started to separate from Freud. He wrote in Symbols of Transformation, this section which was called The Sacrifice, in which he said, it is not just that we return to the mother, but we return to the matrix of being. So therefore, it is not just literal desire to go back to the mother, it is desire to go back to the matrix of being, and from this matrix of being, start to come back up again. So in that time, when he was separated from Freud, is there something happening? Yeah? Okay. In that time that he was separated from Freud, he went through a very difficult time. And in that, can you hear me in the back? Yeah? And in that time, lots of images started to come to him. And it was relatively scary because you have to see that he was a professor at the ETH. And the ETH in Zurich is a technical university, it's like MIT. And he had all these images coming in. And then on a day around this time, I think it was on December 20th, he decides to let himself drop into the world of images. And it goes as follows. He stands on a cliff, he lets himself fall, and he falls along a cliff. And he can see all kinds of things in the cliff, but he keeps on falling. And as he lands with his feet in the mud, or the schlamm. I don't know, the mud is not the right translation. It's yuck, or all this kind of stuff with schlamm. And he falls into that up until his ankles. And so his first communication with that kind of imagination, with this embodied imagination, where the cliffside is fully embodied, it is a cliffside. The ground under his feet is fully embodied. In that embodied state, his first communication with that place is not through his mind, it's through his feet. His feet are the first to notice this world physically. So he then started from there on to write the Red Book. But I think that that's the first experience where imagination is fully embodied. And I am very interested in this embodied imagination. That's what I've been working on since 1971. Now, embodied imagination takes imagination as real. This, Jung already was talking about that in the 20s, I think, when he was talking about the reality of the soul, that it is not that soul is in us, but we are in soul. This is a very old tradition. And the person who talks about this most is one of my teachers. His name is Henri Corbin. Corbin was a scholar of Islamic mysticism. And he translated a word that is used in the Quran. It's called Alam al-Mithal, which he translates as the mundus imaginalis, the world of imagination. And the world of imagination in this tradition, it's a Neoplatonic tradition, in this tradition, the world of imagination is a real world. You access it, and that's a little bit difficult of it, you access it by way of the faculty of imagination, But the imagination that you access in itself is a real world. That comes from the time when we had three forms of reality. We had the physical world, we had the mental or spiritual world, and in between was a world of imagination that was equally real as the mental world and equally real as the physical world. That then started to drop out of our culture in around the 12th, 13th century, when the culture became, when the culture became Aristotelian, when we became a culture with a body and a mind, a culture with matter and spirit, and this whole in-between area dropped out, and we got into what is now called the body-mind conundrum. The body-mind conundrum doesn't exist. It exists as a result of being Aristotelian. It exists because we are in a world where there are two realities and there's no reality in between. The world that I'm interested in is this reality in between. And that reality in between I will try to demonstrate to you. So what we're going to be doing is I will first spend about 40 minutes talking about it. Then we'll have a conversation. Then we'll have a break. And after the break, I will work with one of you for about 20, 25 minutes. Then you'll see what I'm doing. And then we'll continue the conversation from there. So that's what we're going to be doing. So when I use the word imagination, first I have to say that I'm using dreaming as my paradigm for imagination. You can use many things as paradigms for imagination. You can use poetry as your paradigm or painting. I think that dreaming is actually the most complete form of imagination possible. Because while dreaming, you are in a world that is entirely imagined. Everything in a dream is imagination. But the experience of it, and here I have to say that I'm a phenomenologist, so I'm interested in experience. I'm not interested in what things mean. I don't care anything about what things mean. I'm interested in how they are experienced. And so from the standpoint of experience, an image is a place. An image is a place that surrounds you. An image is a place that surrounds you in which you know that you're awake. An image is a place that surrounds you where you know that you're awake and then you wake up. So it is a place that surrounds you where everything around you appears physical and then you wake up, and so you know that it was not physical, but it's quasi-physical. So this is my definition of image, my definition of dreaming, because it holds true the world over. My interest has been to go all around the world and ask people, how do you dream? Because that's been my interest. And what I found is that people always responded in about the same way. That is, I was somewhere and something happened and then I woke up. So that's been my definition of dreaming all along. Somewhere where something happens and then you wake up. Because everything else is cultural. Everything else, like for instance, dreams are about me. That's a cultural notion. When I was in Aboriginal Australia, there was a woman who had a dream, an Aboriginal woman who had a dream, and I described that, I think, in my book Tracks in the Wilderness of Dreaming, who had a dream in which there was a fire, and everybody was sitting around the fire, and there was a group of people, and the group kept on expanding. And I hear this feedback, but anyway. This group kept on expanding and they were dancing a dance around the fire. So I thought, I was not even going to go in the direction, this was 1993, so I was still very Jungianly oriented. I wasn't even going to go to self and expansion of self and all that kind of stuff that a Jungian might go into. I was interested in that she was inviting people into the outback to get to know Aboriginal experience. So I asked her, Do you think that that might have something to do with you inviting people in, and that the circle of understanding is getting bigger and bigger? This was in Pichanjara, and my translator tried to translate it for about 5 minutes, and she had no idea what I was talking about. And so I said, so what then is this dream for you? She said, well, this is a dream of a song and a dance that now I have to teach to my mob, to my people, and then we learn it, and then we will dance it, and it is for the mountains, so the mountains won't lose their memory. Very different. So if, yeah, right? And so this notion that we have that dreams are about us is a very cultural notion. I don't know if dreams are about us. I have no idea if dreams care about us. I just know that they are events that take place that we participate in. And the same thing is dreams are about the ancestors. That's what Nalinchow would say. Or in China, people mainly said dreams are about predicting the future. All these things I am not really interested in, except for that they are phenomena. But I'm not really interested in them as metaphysics. I think psychology is a form of metaphysics. It is all about Western individualism, so dreams are about us. If we are in a Western individualist culture, then dreams are about us. But I don't even know that. So I have no idea what dreams mean, because I don't know if they are about us. I don't know what they are about. So I throw out meaning as well, but meaning in German, and that's such a pity that we don't have that in English. I'm Dutch. That doesn't exist in English. In German, there are two words for meaning. The one is called Bedeutung, and that's the word that Freud used in his interpretation of dreams. Traumdeutung. So that was Bedeutung. And Bedeutung is what something means. And then Jung was much more interested in the other word for meaning, which is Sinn. And Sinn is the experience of meaningfulness. Now, I'm interested in the experience of meaningfulness, and I'm not interested in what things mean.